So please get your significant other, pull a chair up, and we're going to be talking a lot about marriage today. And the title of our sermon is called Wedded Miss. So I brought back some puns with me after vacation. So Wedded Bliss or Wedded Miss? Alice Gregory is a columnist for the New York Times Book Review and has written for the New Yorker, Harper's Magazine, and other American magazines. In an article on marriage in the July 4th, August 2015 issue of The Atlantic, she shares a very glib, kind of blasé attitude towards the sacredness of marriage. She says this, "Yeah, my husband and I got married last fall. Why? Well, because we wanted to have a party. I doubt our friends, our family, or anyone else would have been surprised if we had never gotten married at all. We had just continued living together, trying to love each other, one day maybe having children, all without exchanging rings or vows. The wedding? Well, the wedding was ideal. There was a great cake, and it was accessible by the subway. But afterwards, our life didn't change one bit. It never occurred to us that I would take his name, and I didn't want to. And I definitely didn't want to get pregnant. We live in the same small Brooklyn apartment that we lived in before. Our finances are still only haphazardly half combined. We weren't expecting that our affection would either grow or even diminish, and it hasn't. Getting married wasn't a romantic leap, and it wasn't very pragmatic either. Whatever it was, delightfully unnecessary wrapping on all the already very good presents, perhaps, we just made sure that there was plenty to drink." I think instead of wedded bliss, this woman is wedded miss. She has completely missed the point and intentions that God has for marriage. I'm not sure this person would be a good spokesperson for marriage or really for life at all with the attitude that she has. Marriage is what brings us together today. I'm sorry I couldn't avoid that. But we have all of these views and expectations when it comes to marriage. But have we ever asked ourselves, what does God intend for marriage? Why should we get married? Should we get married at all? What happens when we are in marriage, and how long should marriage last? Marriage is an institution that has been around since the dawn of time. And throughout history, it has had its ups and downs. And right now, I feel like we're continuing in a downward spiral when it comes to marriage. The reasons people offer for getting marriage are as follows. 88% say love. Now, whether that is the choice and the decision to love or the feeling of love, I'm not quite sure. But falling in love, 88%. 81% making a lifelong commitment. 76% get married for companionship. 49% just to have children. 30% a religious ceremony. And 28% financial stability. 23% for legal rights and benefits. In the context that we're going to be looking at today, marriage would probably fall under the having children reason. Marriage in ancient Rome was considered a duty which its main aim was to provide citizens for the empire. Affection between two people did not bond their relationship whatsoever. The father's political estimates, his hopes to get rich or to upgrade their social status, were the only things that mattered. Such relationships were often a very simple focus on procreation. They were set on fathering a descendant, and any signs of affection between the two involved in the marriage was seen as extremely extravagant. So that is the context that Paul is writing. And Paul offers some very countercultural views on marriage, and ones that are just as countercultural today. When it comes to marriage, God's intentions for marriage must shape our involvement in it. It must shape how we act in our marriage, what is expected of us in our marriage. It must shape whether or not we get married in the first place, and it must shape how long our marriages are to last. And those are the three things that we are going to be looking at today. Paul here is answering the Corinthians' question on marriage, and he begins this section with this topic here. So I see three realities that we're going to be talking about today. And the first reality in when it comes to God's intentions is marriage requires mutual obligation, verses 1 through 5. Now, concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife, and each woman is to have her own husband. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer, and come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. When Christians look at marriage, and we look at the state that marriage is in right now, the beauty of marriage has been marred by sin. Christians have the opportunity to restore that image of marriage. And in doing so, to witness to the Christ in the center of it, the Spirit who sustains it, and the God who instituted it. How we behave in our marriages, how we view our marriages, all have the potential to glorify God and to shape us into the image of His Son. One of the first things that we see here today is that marriage requires mutual obligation. My purpose in marriage, and Paul is addressing here and in chapter 8 some very specific questions that the Corinthian church has asked. Specifically, with regards to here being celibate in marriage. And he basically is going to correct this and then kind of agree with it to a certain extent, but not within marriage. Listen to what he says here. Now, concerning the things about which you wrote. So they wrote to him these questions. And what follows here is really important for us to see who is saying what follows. Did Paul say this? Or did the Corinthians say this, that it is good for a man not to touch a woman? And some of your translations may have not to marry a woman. I think the better translation is not to touch a woman. And I think that in order for us to clear up exactly what is going on here, we have to see that I don't believe that Paul is saying that. I think he is quoting part of the question that they asked or what is happening in the church. So what is happening in the church, and we have two things that were going on in the church. Paul just addressed sexual immorality. People who were using the grace of Christ as license to sin, and they were going to prostitutes. And now you have the other extreme. people who are denying things that are allowed in the name of spirituality, here, sex within marriage. And basically, you have practicing celibates in marriage. Not normal, not good, not spiritual whatsoever. And that's what Paul is addressing here. And he wants them to see that if you are married, you have obligations to that partner. Marriage researcher John Gottman has separated couples into two major groups, the masters and the disasters. The masters were still happily together after 6 years. The disasters had either broken up or were chronically unhappy in their marriages. So what is the difference did he discover between the two? He says, in a 1990 study, Gottman carefully observed 130 couples. I don't know if any of the couples here were in that study, but you can let me know afterwards. And he noticed that throughout the day, married partners made requests for connections. And he calls these requests bids. For example, a husband who is a bird enthusiast, I guess that would be a cheap hobby, might notice a goldfinch fly across the yard. He tells his wife, "Hey, look at that beautiful bird." Well, he said he's not just commenting on the bird. He's requesting a response from his wife, a sign of interest, a sign of support, hoping they'll connect, however momentarily, over the bird. The wife now has a choice. She can either respond by turning toward the husband or turning away from her husband. Though the bird bid might seem minor, he says it can actually reveal a lot about the health of the marriage. The bird was important for the husband, and the question is whether his wife recognizes that, respects that, and engages with him in that. She can turn towards him, or she can turn away and express content, saying, "That's stupid," or "Stop bothering me." In the end, what he found out was those that did not turn towards, so 33% of the time they turned towards, the rest of the time they turned away, those were the ones who ended up splitting up. 80% of the time, those who stayed together turned towards meeting some sort of emotional need in their partner. I love that phrase, turning towards one another. It reminds me of when Sarah and I were much younger and we stood before a dark-haired Pastor Dave. I'll show you pictures. And there we were, and you know how the married couple goes up, and what do? They go up together, and you're facing, well, they don't go up together, the guy's up there, and they turn, they face the pastor, and then they do what? They turn towards one another. Folks, that is symbolic of what needs to take place throughout your entire marriage. We turn towards one another and fulfill each other's needs on a constant basis. Here, those physical needs. That is what Paul is talking about here. There is mutual responsibility in marriage. When I get married, I now belong to that person. I do not belong to myself any longer. That person's needs now becomes my priority. That's why Paul understands later on singleness as people who can be what? Fully devoted to the Lord because of this requirement right here. And specifically, he is talking about that physical aspect of marriage. And he qualifies that by the following three verses. He says, "Each man is to have his own wife, Each woman is to have her own husband. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does, and likewise the husband does not have authority over his body, but the wife does. So here's what was happening in Corinth. He goes, stop depriving yourself. There were people who were thinking, because of what Paul said earlier, and they're taking all of this together and they're like, well, you hate sexual immorality, you hate doing this, you say this is wrong, you're single, it's probably better not to touch a woman at all, even if you're married, and they're thinking that is more spiritual. Uh-uh. You cannot be a celibate in your marriage. It is impossible, and it is commanded against. Our bodies don't belong to us. And this passage is for those who are currently involved in marriage and for those who are thinking about it. You get married, you don't belong to yourself. General principle of that. The husband belongs to the wife, and the wife belongs to the husband. And Paul has a high view of marriage, and that is seen throughout Scripture. And we have to also understand that he's talking to a very particular situation. And this phrase comes from the Corinthians, not from Paul. And here these Christians have taken his restrictions on sex and immorality way too far. So on one hand, you have people going to the extreme of using the grace of Christ for license, and now on the other hand, you have people practicing asceticism and denying the things that God allows. And the physical relationship in marriage is extremely important, and it is representative, it represents the oneness of that couple. And we are to celebrate that, not to deny that. And here, the fulfillment of this obligation is aiding the other's fight against the lusts of this world. And as I said, as well as revealing the bond of the oneness of marriage. And here's what we need to see here. This is what Paul is not saying. And what we can't say to our significant other is, you owe me. That's not what he is saying here. The obligation falls on us. So I have to now read this, and I have to say, I owe you. And I belong to you 100%, mind, body, and soul. Our primary relationship is with God, but that also carries over into our relationship with our significant other. When Paul said earlier, talking to them about immorality, and he says, our bodies belong to the Lord, that's primary, but then when we enter into a marriage, now he qualifies that, and he says, your bodies belong to each other. I think that is part of the problem. When we enter into a marriage, we still think we belong to ourselves. And selfishness is one of the biggest problems that we have in marriage today. And we're unwilling to sacrifice ourselves for the sake of that other person. And that is going to cause problems. We enter into a marriage and we have to realize that we no longer belong to ourselves. And these obligations, I want to qualify, are more than the physical ones. There are mutual obligations, and we have to fulfill the needs of our spouses in a variety of ways. There are emotional needs. There are needs of companionship. There are needs of security, respect, love, faithfulness, trustworthiness, and intimacy. And men, I want to point something out here. If we think that we can expect our wives to fulfill the physical needs, and we're not fulfilling those emotional needs or those needs of intimacy, you got another thing coming. Because it is the fulfillment of all of those other needs that make the fulfillment of that need all the better. And we have to realize that we are obligated. The word that is used here when he says stop depriving, it can be rendered stop defrauding, meaning don't take away that which rightfully belongs to the other person. And the one exception that he mentions here is very important for us to see. One exception. What's the exception? Prayer. And that exception shows us how important it is to maintain that triangle in our marriages. God and then the two spouses right here. And coming together in prayer. Praying for each other. Asking God to lead and guide is so crucial to the foundation of our marriage. And if we fail to do that, that's when the problems begin. That is the one exception. But then he even says, but only for a time. What's happening is they're over-spiritualizing these things. And they're thinking themselves more spiritual by refraining from a gift that God has given them within marriage. And Paul says, back up. That's not what I'm talking about here. Marriage requires mutual obligation. The second reality is marriage is an individual option. Verses 6 through 9. These young folks are listening, they're like, I got no part of this. That's good. You got to think really hard about it. Real important. Marriage is an individual option, verses 6 through 9. But I say by way of concession, not of command, yet I wish that all men were even as I myself am. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. But I say to the unmarried and to the widows that it is good for them if they remain even as I. But if they do not have self-control, let them marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. I have to give a little disclaimer before this illustration. It is a joke. It is not theologically correct. Okay, is everyone not theologically correct? There was a many years ago that a beloved pope died and went to heaven. St. Peter greeted him with a firm embrace. Welcome, your holiness. Your dedication and unselfishness in serving your fellow man during your life has earned you great stature in heaven. You may pass through into the gates without delay, and you are granted free access to all the parts of heaven. You are also granted an open door policy to meet with whoever you want, or to read whatever archive you wish. Oh, the Pope was very impressed because he had questions about some of the things and the commands that they had on their time in life. So he often pondered some of those mysteries that the theologians would discuss. And he wanted to know if there were transcripts of these things that he could read. And St. Peter said, yes, there are. They're inside our heavenly library. So the Pope went into the library, and there he was for 2 years digging in there. And all of a sudden, a loud scream of anguish pierced the quiet of the library after 2 years. Immediately, several of the saints and the angels came running, and they found the Pope pointing to a single word on a parchment, repeating over and over again, "There's an R! There's an R! There's an R! It says celebrate!" All right. Instead of celibate. Okay, all right, we're tracking right along here. So, it is really in our best interest to figure this out here and now, not later, right? Do you agree with that? We want to get God's understanding, God's intention behind celibacy and marriage correct now while on earth, not later. So, here we see marriage and celibacy are both a viable option. It is an individual decision that is to be made based on giftings, desires, and opportunities. It is a decision that an individual is to make with the Lord in view. I can relate kind of to what's going on here. So they started exalting celibacy and thinking that that is a more spiritual plane, so to speak. We have done that in our own culture as well. That celibacy, people who are celibate have a better connection with the Lord, that it is more spiritual, and that we've even put restrictions on individuals regarding marriage if they want to enter into a certain vocation. That is not biblical, hands down. I can understand kind of what was going on there because I went through a very similar thing when I was young. When I first became a Christian, I was an aesthetic. I tried to do anything I could to separate myself from any type of fleshly indulgence. And I thought that everything that was harder was more spiritual. I know. It was crazy. Some people knew me. That's why I wanted to not only be a missionary, but I wanted to be a martyr. I actually told my sister on the phone, I'm probably going to die for Jesus, so just be ready for it. Because I thought that was more spiritual, and that's why I wanted to go not to just any place, but I wanted to go to 128-degree Africa with some tribe surrounded by snakes and spiders. And I almost, when I met Sarah, I told her, if you don't think you can go to Africa, we shouldn't be talking to each other. But even before Sarah came into the picture, I would pray to the Lord, Lord, if you want me to remain single, I'll do it. Because I thought that it was more spiritual. My intention was good because I just wanted to give myself to Him. My motivation, I think, was wrong because deep down inside, I wanted to get married pretty bad. I wanted to get married since I was born. But here I was thinking something very similar to this. As a matter of fact, someone called me up and invited me to a group where there would be single girls there. And I hemmed and hawed about that decision because of this. And I'm like, I can't go because part of me wants to go just to meet a girl. That's okay. As a matter of fact, I did go. And you know who I met? I met Sarah. And God gave Sarah to me as one of the best gifts that I have ever had next to salvation. And in Sarah, God called me to the purpose that He had planned for my life, not me. Both ways are acceptable and good as long as they are done with the right motivation, understanding the giftings that God has given us. He didn't gift me for celibacy because I was like this person saying, if singleness is a gift, can I exchange it, please? If we're thinking that way, then maybe He has other plans for us. Here's the thing, though. No matter what circumstance we find ourselves in, single or married, our goal is contentedness in Jesus Christ. That is the goal. And that is when we are ready for either situation. Paul brings the Lord into this because the Lord cares about this aspect of our life. The Lord cares about if you get married or not. As a matter of fact, He has gifted us in a certain way for either situation. Marriage is a gift, but so is celibacy a gift. But in both, the goal is the same, to serve the Lord, whether single or with someone else. Paul has the gift of celibacy, and he understands that not everybody has that gift. He says, I wish that all were like me, but guess what? That's not the case. So therefore, not everyone is going to be celibate. And God works through both situations to achieve his purposeness. As I said, the goal is contentedness in Christ. We cannot go in either direction, saying that marriage is the preferred option or saying that celibacy is the preferred option, and then force that on other people. I think in the church, we tend to do the opposite of what was happening here. We kind of look at people weird if they're not married. Listen to what this guy says. I believe most Christians don't subscribe to the legitimacy of singleness. I am convinced that is the reason for so much pain and hurt in the church about that issue. Directly or indirectly, subtly or not so subtly, we have ascribed to the conviction that singles are unfinished business. We say in groups and we say to people, oh, you're not married yet? Oh, what's a nice girl like you doing single? What you need is a good wife. Found anybody yet? I'm praying that the Lord will lead you to somebody. As a matter of fact, even in books and certain articles, people say, Christians say, that if you will only commit your life to Christ, God will give you a marriage partner. Guess what? That's not found in the Bible. If we commit our lives to Christ, he promises us purpose, fulfillment, and satisfaction no matter what state we find ourselves in. And that is the goal. Paul directs this then towards widows, and he's basically telling them, yes, he wants them to remain as they are, but guess what? If you have a desire or you have a passion, don't suppress that passion and possibly sin in it. Just get married. Just do it. It's okay. You're not sinning if you marry. And remaining celibate is not more spiritual. Both are an option. Paul here is talking against asceticism. Whether we remain celibate, whether we get married, it is a decision that is to be thought through. We are to offer that up to the Lord. It is based on giftings, desires, and of course, opportunity. If there's no one out there to marry, guess what? You're not getting married at that time. But we have to give all of that to him, trusting his plan is the best for our life, and that is what we should want. And we have to be sure before we cross that line, because of what Paul just previously said, when you say, I do, you do. You are in it. You don't belong to yourself. You belong to the other person. And when you say, I do, it's for the long run. Which brings us to our third and final reality. Marriage is to be a permanent condition, verses 10 through 16. I'm going to cover a lot here, so just bear with me in this text. But to the married, I give instructions, not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband. But if she does leave, she must remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband, and that the husband should not divorce his wife. But to the rest, I say, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband and he consents to live with her, she must not send her husband away. For if the unbelieving husband is sanctified, for the unbelieving husband is sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified through her believing husband. For otherwise your children are unclean, but now they are holy. Yet if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. But God has called us to peace. For how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? Who has been married the most times in history? Well, maybe some of you would guess King Henry VIII. King Henry VIII has been married 6 times. How about Elizabeth Taylor? Elizabeth Taylor has been married 8 times. TV actress Zsa Zsa Gabor, 9 times, and they would all be very top candidates. However, there's a little-known man named Glenn Scotty Wolfe, and he would easily claim the title of the most married person by eclipsing all 3 combined. Starting at the age of 22, Wolfe married 29 times throughout his life. Some of those marriages ended in days, while others lasted a few years. People were wondering what fueled his insatiable yearning to move on. Those who have studied Wolfe from a psychological perspective suggest that as soon as he committed to a person, he experienced varying degrees of remorse. His marriage would experience bumps in the relational road. Well, I guess he wasn't really prepared for those bumps. And he started to look for other options and eventually would jump ship. How did he die? Well, though he reportedly fathered over 40 children, many of his ex-spouses were still living. He died alone and penniless. His lifeless body, with a tattoo of a tied knot on his forearm, went unclaimed in the morgue for months. Here, this man engaged in the institution of marriage repeatedly, but he repeatedly missed the intention of marriage. Marriage is to be permanent. And I have said this before, and I will say it again. The Church of Jesus Christ will not be heard in speaking of the sanctity of marriage between a man and a woman when our own marriages are in shambles and are ending for unbiblical reasons. We have an opportunity when we stick with our significant other through thick and thin and sin to reveal the covenant relationship that we have with Jesus Christ. Because he is the one who said, I will not leave you, I will not forsake you. And we have been unfaithful to him repeatedly. The church is in a very dilapidated state right now when it comes to marriage and divorce. We need to regain and understand God's intention for marriage is a permanent one. And I want to say this before I proceed. I understand all of us are sinners. All of us are in need of God's grace, and all of us have done things in our past that we are not proud of. And this experience may be part of that past, and I want to tell you that there is grace, forgiveness, reconciliation, and redemption in Jesus Christ. That's what we're here for. And God can redeem what we have broken. But as we move forward, as individuals in a church, this is what we need to believe, and this is what we need to practice. Paul says this. He says, not I, but the Lord. He is talking about, he's going back. Paul had access to either the oral or the written tradition of Jesus Christ. We know this because of what he says later on concerning the Lord's Supper. So when he says, not I, but the Lord, and then after this he's going to say, not the Lord, but I, that doesn't make it any less of a command. Paul is just reflecting back on what Jesus actually said. So to divorce, he's writing in a culture that was just, it was so easy to divorce in the Roman period. It was much, much easier than it is right now. So to divorce, right, only the both parties to divorce in a marriage, they just simply had to consider themselves not married. And they said it was nice if you told the other person, but guess what? You didn't have to. Oh, where'd you go? I'm living with my new wife. Oh, we're not married? No, I'm sorry. I thought I'd let you know afterwards. They didn't even have to let each other know. That's how easy it was to divorce. There were no legal hoops that they had to jump through. A man could divorce his wife for adultery, for drunkenness, or for making copies of the household keys. I don't understand that, but I guess some reason that really upset the husbands when wives would make copies of the household keys. But now, even in America, it's getting very, very easy to divorce each other, and that is only adding to the problem. And that is happening because of these no-fault laws that came about in the 1960s, which in a nutshell established that breaking up a marriage is acceptable and the reasons for doing so are nobody's business. And it also removed divorce's negative stigma, allowing couples to regain their good standing in society. We need to regain the negative stigma of divorce in the Church of Jesus Christ. And we need to begin to hold each other accountable. That is why we have witnesses at weddings, folks. They are there to witness the vows that are said. And part of those vows are to death, till death do us part, right? And that is the ideal. He's talking about what Jesus says in the gospel. So let's turn to one of those passages. We'll turn to Matthew 19. This is starting at verse 3. Some of the Pharisees came to Jesus testing him and asking, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all?" And he answered and said, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, 'For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh.' So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate." They said to him, "Why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and send her away?" He said, "Because of the hardness of your heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning it has not been this way. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another woman commits adultery." The disciples said to him, "If the relationship of a man with his wife is like this, it is better not to marry." Paul again emphasizes the oneness of marriage. Think about what he is saying here. We don't form that bond. Who forms that bond? God does. So therefore, dividing a marriage except for adultery is in rebellion against what God has created. We have taken what God has made as one and we tear it apart. One flesh. Permanence. And here he does give the exception, and the exception is just that. It's an exception. It is not to be the standard. And even if someone does commit adultery, let's go back to Hosea. That's the ideal. Love and forgiveness. Because that is what we have in Jesus Christ. Numerous times we have been unfaithful to him. But he has never left us. We have to go back to what God says about divorce, and he absolutely hates it. He hates it because it's a reflection of his covenant with man. And God doesn't break his covenants. Listen to the disciples' response. Whoa! Hey, if this is what it's about, guess what? It's better not to marry. And I think that's the idea that we need to have before we enter into that relationship. Are you in it for the long run? Because if you're entering into that relationship and you think you're just going to jump ship as soon as the waters get high and the seas get rough, you're in for something different. We're not thinking biblically if we are thinking in that way. Marriage was designed to be permanent while here on earth because it reflects the relationship that we have with Jesus Christ. A relationship of self-sacrifice, a relationship of forgiveness, a relationship of reconciliation, and a relationship of grace. And we are not to look for excuses, some of which they bring to his attention here. What would be a good reason not to stay married? Well, if you became a Christian and the other person wasn't a believer. Hey, Paul, they're not a believer. They're not following Jesus Christ. My children are going to be raised by an unbelieving parent. That's not good, is it? Shouldn't I just leave? Uh-uh. It's not an option. Unless that person wants to leave. And I think when we look at what Paul is saying here and look at how he directs their attention to how God can then use that situation, that is what we are to say in any difficulty that we find in our marriage. We don't know how God will use us. We don't know. And the only way we are going to find out is if we remain in it. That is the focus. How can God use my present situation for me to better reflect Jesus Christ to my spouse? Whether that person is a believer or an unbeliever, the goal remains the same. God using us and working through us to bring Christ to our significant other. The purpose of marriage. This presents not an obstacle, but what? An opportunity. An opportunity to bring glory to God, and an opportunity in this case to bring this unbeliever to Christ. What a great opportunity that is. God desires peace. He doesn't want the Christian to upset the apple cart by leaving the situation if that unbeliever wants to remain. The goal is to present Christ to our spouse in any way, shape, or form we can. A woman tells a story about her decision to remain in the circumstance that Paul talks about here. She became a believer and her husband was not. She says, Satan immediately began his work bent on the destruction of our marriage. I cannot describe to you how swiftly he moved, and he will move on your marriages. He continued shaping and molding true hatred for the one thing my husband despised, those religious types. And now I was one of them. I weighed my devotion for Christ against my devotion to my kids and my family, and I asked whether a broken marriage with Christ was better than a marriage without Christ. But gradually, Christ's words became my words. His love filled me and poured out of me, and I was able to love the man who called me his enemy. I found that I could love my husband with a resolve that I never had before. In the year and a half that has followed, many blessings have been bestowed upon my family. It may not be apparent to my husband, she says, but our marriage is very different because of Jesus Christ. Christ is at the center and is shaping our partnership in a very new and distinctly Christian way. Additionally, my husband has changed dramatically from the man he was 2 years ago. He told me that I should go ahead and attend church and gave his blessing to do so. My children began to go to youth group, and now both of my children are worshiping with me weekly. And when I asked my husband if he would support my daughter and me to be part of a missions trip to Mexico, he responded with, "We'll make it happen." She says, "I've entrusted my husband into Christ's care, and I'm okay with that. I've learned many lessons in this past year and this past year and a half, but none so much as loving and trusting my Lord." We never know what will happen. The kids and the husband are changing. Why? Because of the influence of the Holy Spirit in that believing wife. It is a question, it is something, a statement that we need to say to ourselves over and over and over again. We never know how God is going to use us if we follow His intention and remain in our marriages through thick and thin. God's intentions for marriage needs to shape our involvement in it. It requires mutual obligation. It is an individual option, and it is to be a permanent condition. Father, thank you for your word, and thank you for the practical guidance that you offer in your word. I know many things that we talked about today are difficult and just remind us of our past mistakes, but Lord, you are good, and we have forgiveness, redemption, and grace in Jesus Christ, a grace that will remain with us until we see you again. Help us, Lord, to follow your intentions that we read here today, bringing you and you alone glory in all we do. Amen.